Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar Alturai, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you again. We've got a lot to talk about today, so why don't you run us through the agenda?
Certainly. So we'll be touching on some econ data releases, starting off with the SLUSR, Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, before diving into some ADP employment data. Then we'll touch on some county-level GDP data that the BEA released, and then move over to the consumer side and look at some consumer sentiment data, as well as the small business optimism data coming out from NFIB, before touching on some of the earnings takeaways that we're hearing from banks and asset managers. And we have a special conversation with our colleague Andrew Pabon. We'll cover some of the latest data that we've seen across the CRE debt space before we close out the call with the usual data releases and earnings calls. But before we dive into all of that, Cole, how about you give us the stat of the day?
Excellent. Yeah, this is our new recurring segment this year. The number or stat of the day is 61. That is the age of the median multifamily property that sold in 2025. In other words, the typical apartment asset trading last year was built in 1964. Just 5 years ago, the median age was 54, so a difference of 7. So today, multifamily assets that trade are actually materially older than every other major property type. So roughly 40 years for office, 41 for both industrial and retail. So I think that's pretty interesting. Big driver, I think, of the upward shift in age that continues to get happened is not what is built, but what is not built. Commercial construction slowed after the GFC, and development eventually came back in some sectors and hasn't reached its pre-GFC pace in others. I think you get an investable CRE universe that continues to age. And now you're seeing multifamily assets trading today, or the typical asset, the median asset, is actually in its 60s. So just a sampling of the type of data that you can get from our Reonomy platform. That's a number coming off of some of the work we do for the U.S. CRE Investment and Transactions quarterly report, but thought that was an interesting nugget to share from the past year. So Omar, now I'm sure folks want to hear about some of the econ releases we've had for the last few weeks, and we'll do these chronologically, so we'll pitch it back and forth, but you looked at the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey. How about you run us through that?
Absolutely. So the Fed released the January 2026 Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, or SLOOS, on February 2nd, covering changes in bank lending standards and demand, really seen through the fourth quarter of 2025. Really, the big picture is that the post-2023 credit tightening cycle is largely over. C&I, or commercial and industrial lending standards, are back to near neutral after peaking around 50% net tightening in mid-2023. Demand from large and mid-market firms turned positive for the first time in over a year, driven by M&A financing and CapEx needs. On the consumer side, the story is a bit softer. Mortgage and auto demand weakened, and banks expect credit quality to deteriorate for non-prime borrowers in 2026. And there's a kind of a new wrinkle that was popping up in the most recent data, which is that banks are now really factoring AI exposure into C&I lending decisions, favoring adopters and really pulling back from firms that are negatively or expected to be negatively affected by the adoption and rollout of AI. But within this data, and why you're probably tuned in, is there's rich CRE insights here as well. So specifically for CRE, the bank credit thaw that I think we've touched on many times, or it seems presented on multiple times throughout the last year, it is very real and it's still underway. and really was showing quite clearly through this Q4 sluice data, multifamily lending standards flipped to net easing. I think this really highlights that banks are feeling much more comfortable around multifamily than they have in the past. You know, multifamily is a big space, and I know we touched on there are some concerns around multifamily. You know, I think as we noted on our last podcast, touching on some of the comments coming out of CREFC early in the year, you can't paint with a broad brush for the entire sector. Ultimately, the easing that was reported in the sluice data was the first time that we saw this easing really since early 2022. Non-farm, non-residential standards also crossed into that easing territory, though slightly at a lesser extent than multifamily. And that's been a pretty dramatic reversal that we've seen in the sluice data over the last really 2.5 years, when 65 to 70% of banks were reporting net tightening across all CRE types. The sluice data also has information and data points on the demand side for CRE financing. And if you look at the demand side, you can see that non-farm, non-residential loan demand turned positive again, the first positive reading in nearly 3 years. But there was a caveat in the sluice data where large banks are really driving the easing in CRE, while smaller banks remain a bit more cautious. Given how concentrated CRE exposure is at the smaller bank, whether the community and regional bank level, the headline numbers of this easing could be a little bit skewed or might not actually reflect the on-the-ground perspective. Again, that being said, I think this is still a pretty good pulse check or data point that characterizes banks are broadly coming back into CRE and there is still demand for CRE financing from the banks. Moving out of the bank space and moving a little bit closer to the current, why don't we look at some of the employment numbers you were seeing from ADP?
Sure. And before we do that, I did want to mention for those folks who tuned into the last podcast we had with Andy Boettcher, a lot of the predictions that he made about bank CRE lending starting in 2026 seem to have come true from the sluice data here. So we'll have to keep an eye out for the next few releases. But ADP employment data came out on February 4th, so just a couple of days after that. And showed that private sector employment added just 22,000 jobs in January 2026. So that was a significant slowdown from the revised 37,000 in December, well below most forecasts. And so you still have this weak hiring momentum. You've heard this kind of low hire, low fire that categorized much of 2025 and looks like it's continuing that way into 2026. Job creation was actually concentrated in education and health services, but sectors like manufacturing, professional business services saw outright declines. But interestingly, annual pay for job stayers remained elevated. It was up 4.5% on the year. Persistent wage growth, even as hiring continues to cool. So as of this recording, we have not gotten the official government payrolls data, which does include public sector as well. That was postponed. It was supposed to occur last week. So the ADP data is taking on a little bit of extra weight for those trying to interpret labor trends like us, but we will get the January report here fairly soon. But really, it suggests a labor market that's softening at the beginning of 2026. Sluggish private hiring is going to damper consumer spending and confidence, going to influence broader economic growth. I think for us in CRE, that's going to translate into more cautious leasing activity, particularly in these sectors tied directly to demand through labor, and one being office. So a lot of the office using employment sectors are either not growing or outright shrinking. So sectors tied to health and education might show some relative strength, but those aren't necessarily cyclical. So weakness in professional services and manufacturing are going to be dampers on other sectors and signal some uneven recovery in CRE. But We'll have to see what the official BLS report says, if it also confirms these softer job gains. And of course, the ADP release typically comes out just a few days before anyway. If it does confirm those, it could bolster arguments for more accommodative monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. Read that as rate cuts, but we'll just have to see. Omar, some other data that came out last week, and I don't think this is one we've covered before. What'd you see in the BEA's county level GDP data?
Yeah, so the Bureau of Economic Analysis released its 2024 GDP by county estimates on the 5th of February. This is a, as you pointed out, it's not something that we usually cover. Part of that is because it doesn't come out all that frequently, and it tends to be a little bit dated. But this was the first time that the BEA combined county GDP and personal income into a single release. And even though it's covering 2024 GDP, it's the granularity that really makes it interesting to look at. So the release covers 3,106 U.S. counties and county equivalents, and I think can help shape and understand the size and the geographic concentration of economic growth as well as individuals' income trends. So let's look at the high-level takeaways. 2024 real GDP grew in 73% of the counties and declined in 26%, while personal income rose in 89% of the counties and fell in 11%. I think in terms of the key trends and takeaways, the most striking GDP pattern is that really every single large county or every county that has a population of 500,000 or more posted positive GDP growth. Not a single one declined. And this really stands in sharp contrast to the small counties, which are effectively defined as counties that have populations of 100,000 people or fewer. Of those small counties, 789 posted declines in GDP. This is something that I think speaks to the concentration of growth in larger counties, but also I couldn't help but see the K-shaped economy or K-shaped narrative that we heard throughout 2025 coming into play here, where the big get bigger and the rest kind of suffer. You have this kind of tale of two trajectories really playing out. If we look at the personal income growth, again, you see a little bit more of that K-shapedness, or I don't know if that's a word, but K-shape, as all medium and large counties. So now going 100,000 of 100,000 or more, because I'm grouping that medium size in there, they saw positive income growth, while any and all of the counties that experienced income declines were concentrated in those small counties. So those are populations less than 100,000. I would also call out that when you are looking at the relationship of where there was positive GDP growth and broad economic growth and personal income growth, you can kind of make this comparison of where are people earning versus where is the production and where's the economy kind of happening. And you can see that the income growth was far more widespread than output growth or GDP growth. So income growth was seen in 89% of the counties, while GDP growth was seen in only 73% of those counties. This really could suggests that contributions to income really could be coming from investments. It could be coming from transfer payments, or perhaps it's indicative of cross-county commuting. So the difference of where somebody lives and where they're actually earning. And I think that is something that is curious to see play out more over a longer time period, particularly after we're coming out of this pandemic, which everybody moved to remote, and then it's the back to office. Meanwhile, you see the K-shape really coming through the broader economy as well, hurting some industries and certain size companies more than others. But the persistent GDP to personal income gap is something to also watch specifically from the CRE lens. You could argue that income growth is actually more important than real GDP for certain sectors. If you think about multifamily, if you think about retail. But that being said, the economic growth is pretty critically important over the long term in terms of building up attractive, growing communities that then will have enough economic diversity to ultimately attract businesses and to keep households there. So the next release of this county level data is not really going to be available until December 2026, assuming that the publication schedules don't get bumped back any further. And that'll cover the 2025 period. And I'm interested to see if that kind of those K-shapes and the GDP growth to personal income growth trends remain, because I think this will be a pretty interesting data set to start kind of mining a little bit more to see how the AI transition and adoption and development and build out is actually affecting individual counties. But moving to a data release that is a little bit more frequent, a little bit more, I think, understood and something that we've covered a few more times. Cole, why don't you walk us through the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment release?
Yeah, and we actually have business and consumer sentiment because the NFIB data came out just a few days later. So we'll kind of pair both those together. I like that they come out in quick succession. But this is the preliminary readout of the consumer sentiment index for February 2026. This came out on February 6th. Headline index edged up to 57.3 from 56.4 in January. That was the third consecutive monthly increase. However, sentiment remains historically very low. It's hovering near levels typically associated with periods of economic stress. We're right at or slightly above some of the levels recorded in 2011 or at the height of the GFC in 2008-2009. So it's interesting that this reading is coming now at a time of relative economic expansion. But the current conditions index did improve modestly, but expectations softened. Typically, you see the current level much higher than expectations, but these are actually running in tandem. But the other thing that they survey is inflation expectations. We had one-year inflation expectations coming in at 3.5%. That's down from 4% in January, a huge drop. Long-run inflation expectations, which they measure as five-year forward-looking, ticked up to 3.4%, but that was only up slightly. And this is kind of where you would expect those long-term inflation expectations to be, just looking at the kind of long-term trend. But despite the modest improvement in sentiment, the sentiment at these levels suggests that households remain very cautious about discretionary spending, making large purchases, or any additional financial commitments. And so for the broader economy, this points to a consumer sector that's stabilizing but still very fragile. There's very limited tolerance for any negative shocks in employment or prices. And I think for CRE, this historically depressed sentiment does explain some ongoing hesitation about some of the consumer-facing sectors. So portions of retail, hospitality, any combinations thereof that are experiential, where confidence often matters as much as income. So we'll have to see what happens with this release, but we're still floating around in the kind of high 50s, which is a really historically depressed level for consumer confidence. The next release we got is from the NFIB, or the National Federation for Independent Business. They produce their Small Business Economic Trends report each month. And for January, this came out on February 10th. The headline index is the Small Business Optimism Index, and that slipped modestly in February to 99.3. That's down 0.2 points from January, but it is still in line or just slightly above the 52-year average of 98. So there are 10 index components, only three of them improved. That was led by a 6-point increase in expected real sales. But one other piece of this, which actually is not a component of the index, but is worth mentioning, is the uncertainty index, which rose to 91. So high confidence, but also high uncertainty. Now, part of that was growing hesitation around expansion decisions, so read as the willingness to take up additional real estate. But the Small Business Employment Index eased to 101.6. That is still above its long-term average, so continued but cautious hiring. Capital spending stayed relatively firm, marking the highest share of owners making outlays since late 2023, but plans for future investments actually declined. So for the broader economy and for our industry more specifically, I think the data do point to a stable but cautious condition for small businesses, above average optimism, improving sales expectations. I think those suggest small businesses will continue to support baseline economic activity, providing some support for demand for retail, various service spaces, small office users. But at the same time, you have elevated uncertainty, persistent cost pressures, labor quality concerns, insurance cost current concerns that I think are going to delay expansion and new leasing decisions, even if they're fairly optimistic about it. But Omar, I think a good note to transition on there, if we're talking about financial conditions, how about you give us a rundown of earnings? A lot of the big banks and asset managers have already gone through theirs. What are you hearing in some of those earnings calls?
Yeah, and you are spot on that the middle of earnings season, as companies are reporting their Q4 and full year 2025 results, the REITs and real estate earnings will really be starting over the next few days, or starting this week as you're listening to this podcast, and we'll run through really the next 2 to 3 weeks. But we have already heard from most of the big banks and many of the largest asset managers. So wanted to kind of highlight as the REIT earnings and the real estate service firms are kicking off their calls, we wanted to lay the foundation and give the capital context. So the big picture really across both asset managers and the banking sector, record AUM and fee-related earnings really dominated the asset management side. Blackstone pulled in $239 billion of inflows for the year. BlackRock across the $11.5 trillion AUM threshold. Private credit remains the really primary fundraising engine across the asset managers, though there's been a lot of kind of media and investor scrutiny around business development company redemptions and software credit exposure, which really, I would say, intensified over the last week. AI infrastructure, which includes data centers, power generation, and grid build-out, has become arguably the single largest investment theme across asset managers. Brookfield is launching a $100 billion-plus AI infrastructure program. On the bank side, every major institution really was guiding their net interest income growth in 2026, fueled by fixed rate asset pricing and mid-single digit loan growth, as well as declining deposit costs. On the banking side, investment banking revenues rebounded sharply. Citi posted a record M&A in Q4. It was up a whopping 84%. Carlyle led the industry in IPO proceeds over the last 2 years, so 24-25. And AI technology spend within these financial institutions was noted on a number of calls. I think the biggest one is B of A noting that they rolled out Copilot to their 200,000 plus employees, and noted that AI is cutting their coding efforts by 30%. Some efficiency gains on the banking front and some investment opportunities on the asset management front in the kind of AI theme. On to CRE specific comments and color from the calls. The overall CRE story from the banks and asset managers is really stabilization and bifurcation. It doesn't sound like anything entirely new, but there were some, because we were talking about stabilization and bifurcation throughout much of 25. But a few call outs. U.S. Bancorp reported its first CRE loan growth in 11 quarters, driven by multifamily and industrial. Wells Fargo, their CRE office reserve coverage sits at about 10%. And they noted that they're seeing valuations stabilizing, but the older stock of office remains challenged. It's a smaller, but still notable bank, Flagstar. Their total CRE balances, they've brought those down by a quarter or 25% since the end of 2023, and they continue to rebalance away from CRE and towards C&I. And then hopping back over to the asset manager side, Cohen & Steers sees REIT earnings growth accelerating to roughly 8% in 2026 to 2027 as new supply drops and demand picks up. A few other company callouts. Blackstone noted that there is a resumption of interest in real estate, and not just from the institutional capital side, but from their wealth channel. And that retail wealth channel is a theme that I think really popped up last year, but is getting echoed across other calls. TPG is actively working on a non-traded REIT with multiple large channel partners. AllianceBernstein's private market platform, which is partially anchored in CRE debt, saw 18% year-on-year growth. And then finally, Brookfield noted investing in brand awareness to grow their wealth channel. One of the kind of like big CRE takeaways from all these calls is that banks are cautiously re-entering the CRE lending space. And even if they're doing it cautiously, this is hugely welcomed by the CRE industry, given the kind of lion's share of lending that banks have done in the past. However, as they're entering and re-entering now, they're finding that non-bank lenders, like many of these asset managers, have already moved into the space and they also see the opportunity. So while this is leading to some collaborations on different platforms and programs across asset managers and banks, it is also increasing overall competition, which then is reshaping or, you know, giving a good foundation for the overall CRE financing landscape. The shift that we've seen in this lending landscape isn't really just sentiment, or it's not something that we're just picking up from these calls. It is something that we're actively seeing in some of our own survey data, which is coming from the U.S. Debt Capital Market Survey that we put out each quarter. We wrapped up the latest survey right at the start of this year, and we've been able to break down and understand all of the results. But one thing that we wanted to do on this episode was talk with one of our colleagues to really cover what we've seen in the data and what he's seen in his regular work deliverables to clients on the debt valuation side. So to better understand how CRE financing is thawing and how lending competition is really impacting the cost of capital for CRE, here's a conversation with our colleague, Andrew Pabon. Andrew, welcome back to the show. Really excited to have you on and talk the CRE lending landscape and really dive into the results of our 4Q 2025 U.S. Debt Capital Market Survey.
Glad to be back, Omar. Thanks very much for having me.
So after having been able to really digest the survey results, which captured more than 1,500 individual quotes from both borrowers and lenders, what was one of the biggest takeaways that you found from the fourth quarter results?
I'd say the most prominent theme is relief for borrowers, or said differently, the availability of financing seems to truly be back on the table for investors. As we've discussed, it's probably coming from three main sources, or the key cost drivers associated with that. First, declining benchmarks. And obviously, there was a bit of a roller coaster there over the course of 2025, but ultimately saw those drops come in once we got to the very end of the year. Second, spread compression. We discussed this a bit when we chatted last about the third quarter results, and I think the fourth quarter results are further pointing in that general trend and direction. And third, really tied in with that spread commentary, is that increasing competition. So the fact that there are more people really coming to the table to put forth term sheets, to have some of those quotes come through, I think are all three significant factors that are helping really just increase the availability of financing and make things a little bit more favorable for overall market and capital debt.
That makes sense. And it really sounds like the perfect storm, or maybe not a storm, it's like perfect weather for borrowers. You mentioned declining benchmarks. You had declines across the three main benchmarks, the SOFR coming down 34 basis points. This is the average SOFR for the fourth quarter. The 5-year and the 10-year also dropped 13 and 16 basis points, respectively, quarter over quarter. Then that spread compression that you talked about is adding on to the benchmark reduction, which we saw in kind of the high level results of the survey showed that spreads tightened across pretty much all product types. And particularly, we saw more tightening for that lower leveraged floating rate senior short-term financing structure, which saw spreads really come down about 11%. Compared to the prior quarter. And then what I think is driving this spread compression is that intensifying competition. So borrowers received an average of 5.2 competitive quotes per deal. This is up from an average of 4.7 competitive quotes a year ago. And this is really benefiting the borrowers and making overall CRE debt financing not only more available, which you see with that competition, but more affordable from the benchmark and spread movement. Were these results tying into what you were hearing and seeing, given that the survey is a bit of a snapshot and a summary of the quarter, but you're in this day in, day out? Is this something that you also saw throughout the fourth quarter outside of the survey period?
Yeah, absolutely. And in working with a multitude of different lender type clients, particularly debt funds, the fact that we've seen those originations pick up and have seen that incremental spread compression come through on those new deals that come within valuation scope are really all ultimately supporting everything that we just discussed. And I think that you described it perfectly in that it's a perfect storm. It's really helping both sides of the table. And it's also reflective of the fact that lenders do want to get out there and put more of that capital to work.
And I guess part of the reason of the lenders warming up, I would assume that the collateral values or the comfort with collateral kind of plays a role in that. Is that something that your kind of qualitative or your kind of anecdotal experience through the quarter would justify or challenge?
I think that's fair, but with a bit of a caveat in that all of that collateral basis reset that we've seen over the last few years for commercial real estate has bifurcated. And this is when you dive into each and every one of the different property types and comes down to individual property performance or individual asset performance. So for those that have maintained occupancy or have suffered less negative impacts from decreasing rents, from decreasing occupancy, again, across property types, so it's not just office that we're talking about here. Those have been able to, again, thinking back about weather again, weather the storm a little bit more and ultimately have a place and an interest from both sides of the table when it comes to financing. However, you do have on the collateral side those that have felt the pain much more. And then we're talking about another sector, right? We're talking about working through modifications, trying to figure out ultimately how to get to an exit. And what we have seen, particularly over the last year and a half, 2 years, is a little bit of that shift more towards those or some of these borrowers handing back the keys. So these are themes, obviously, that have been around and discussed for some time, but we definitely still see pop up as we go through our valuation work each quarter, and in particular here in fourth quarter as well.
A major factor and determinant of the overall cost of capital for CRE debt is really driven by moves in the benchmark yields. And you tied that into kind of like one of the main kind of takeaways up top. Let's do a double click, dive in a little bit deeper. What did you see in the benchmark yield space through the last quarter? And how did that really impact overall CRE debt?
Yeah, as you mentioned, we touched on it a tad, but ultimately, those coming down, or maybe a way to rephrase or reframe it, is thinking about it from the yield curve perspective. So the fact that over the course of 2024, that was pretty sharply inverted, we definitely saw that flatten at the end of 2025, again, helping tie into this overall commentary that things are ultimately better when it comes to debt financing. If we said double click or peel back the layers, at least on a couple components, where is that really coming from? Again, straightforward here, but short-term rates falling faster than long-term rates is helping with that flattening. And then also a little bit of a product shift. If we think about the types of debt that some of these borrowers are leaning into, heading more into fixed rate, maybe versus floating, which has definitely been much more available and in vogue here, in particular over the last few years, is changing a little bit of that conversation and helping with that yield curve normalization overall topic and theme. So taking a step further into that particular topic, I would say what's interesting is 5-year fixed rate, you know, paper has been also something that has been or provided a little bit more of that flexibility for borrowers. Now that there is a little bit more of this stabilization, let's call it, or a little bit stronger sentiment around ultimately what the Fed is expected to do heading into 2026 and what overall benchmark yields are expected to do here in the near to midterm, it's lending itself to focus and shift back towards a little bit more of that longer term dated paper. So again, all of those things, I think, coming into play here as we think about just some of these benchmark trends.
And so if you take the benchmark normalization and some flattening of the curve that's driving overall reduced all-in costs, but then you couple on the spread compression that we've seen, what jumped out to you in terms of, or how would you characterize the all-in rate movements that we've seen across CRE financing and at least through the end of 25 and coming into 26?
Yeah, I'd say the simple and straightforward answer is broad-based all-in rate reductions. And I think that this is really where we're able to lean in on a bit of the history of data that we now have with our capital market survey to look at changes over a longer time horizon. Across the entire market, what does that translate into? All-in debt costs fell about 45 bips quarter over quarter, but looking at it on a year-over-year perspective, about 66 bips. So again, all of these trends that we're talking about are continuing to head in the same direction.
Were there any differences that you saw or that jumped out to you in terms of collateral types and the all-in rate movements that you saw across the overall pricing matrices?
Absolutely. And I think the first one that stands out and not really a surprise is multifamily and industrial. That's where we continue to hear the most about, where there continues to be the most investor interest, and where, quite frankly, there continues to be most transaction activity. So despite some of the pressures that maybe are a little bit more market or submarket specific for some of those two product types, multifamily and industrial continues to be where we see a lot more of that overall spread compression and obviously all-in rate reductions. Another interesting area is around construction. So a little bit of relief for that sector or that particular strategy. So financing for construction is much more plentiful is really the way to put it here, consistent with what we've talked about here in the last couple of themes, and have seen that, right, also come through in some of the data points of our survey. On the flip side, again, honing in solely on fourth quarter, was interesting to note that there were a couple sectors that did see some pops, such as full service hotels and some retail malls. If we try to take that out over a longer term period, not too much change.
And I love how you broke that down, because if you think about kind of residential and industrial, that's the space that has seen the tightest pricing and most steady pricing for years. And to see that they still hold that crown in terms of having the lowest all-in rates, I think that's maybe not breaking news. But then on the other end of the kind of risk spectrum in terms of collateral, you have construction, and you're seeing those all-in rates come down as well. And so if you take that kind of picture together, you got pretty much all-in rate reductions across the board, with the exception of those two outliers that you noted. Yeah, I know we're pretty early in the year, but conferences have already started to pick up and you're talking with clients every day. Do these survey results mesh with and align with what you're hearing and seeing across portfolios and with your industry connections?
Most definitely. I think one area or one particular conference that we can point to is CREFC that just happened here in January of 2026. And again, multifamily industrial, big key topics, product types that were discussed significantly. Office is another one that has always been brought up here over the last couple of years for different reasons, but we can dive into that here in a moment. The main thing that I would say, particularly around multifamily and industrial, is commentary from those conferences, from different speakers over the course of different panels, is really thinking that spreads are as tight as they can be right now. And we've seen that, right? And some of the new originations that come through for our valuation process. The fact that we're looking at spreads that are consistent with where we were in 21, 22, I think is evidence of the fact that all things have come a little bit full circle in a sense when we're talking particularly around spreads and what we're seeing come through from actual transactions.
Outside of the, you know, resi industrial, construction, hospitality, and malls, were there any other kind of major collateral trends that you saw coming out of the 4Q results?
I think the biggest one, and right, we just planted the seed for it, is around office. So the fact that the commentary across the industry at conferences with our clients as we go through valuations each quarter, and again, here specifically from our debt capital market survey, is that office has a space and is getting more interest once again. And lenders are beginning to selectively re-engage after years of kind of ultimately avoiding it. We'll peel back some of the layers here. Where is it really coming from, or where is it most focused? I would say it shifts into that quality over quantity. And again, there's a lot of different specific markets, specific layers of office, but quality really reigns. And I would say across our quarterly valuation conversations and presentations, even from our equity advisory team, and really throughout the overall industry, that has been the biggest differentiator for office over the last few years. I think that's most apparent when we're speaking to occupancy, WALT, and even the quality of that tenancy in each of these buildings. Those are key factors that are really coming into play when it ultimately boils down to, is anyone really interested in getting into this deal or providing financing for this particular office transaction?
Yeah, and I think one of the clearest signals was coming just from that the quoting activity that we saw in Q4, where office quotes really jumped 4 percentage points in terms of the total quote mix that we get for across different collateral types. And they were representing about 17% of all the quotes collected. It's not only that binary situation of, is office lending happening? Yes, no. It's actually, you're starting to see it come back that more competition, more lenders, as well as more borrowers are putting out or getting quotes respectively. And so I think that's a great sign for the office market and the overall kind of health of the collective CRE universe, given office's kind of significance and the particular kind of sentiment that office seems to drive for the asset class as a whole. I'll throw in one data point to color this return to office lending. In the fourth quarter, we saw all-in rates for office fall to 609 basis points or 6.1%. That's down about 40 basis points from where they were a year ago. So you're seeing that spread compression just across the capital stack as more lenders are coming in and issuing quotes, more borrowers are receiving quotes, and ultimately the cost of financing office is coming down. So with the first quarter of 26 in full swing, do you think that the fourth quarter results are still hold up in terms of coloring the environment that we're operating in?
We're chatting here, Omar, the first week of February, and for the most part, I think they do still hold up. And that's notwithstanding some of the broader capital market swings that we've seen over the last week. But really, in general, right, commercial real estate tends to move a little bit slower. So I think that impact from some of that shift with and commentary around AI, while very much impacts some areas of overall commercial real estate, ultimately is not going to shift the Titanic here anytime soon. So that being said, I think some interesting themes that we're monitoring, that we're mindful of, and that even came up again, thinking back to CREFC here in January of 2026, is some of the growing concern and commentary around multifamily. I think this is where we see a little bit of the split or the two paths potentially taken for multifamily, given the amount of collateral basis reset over the last few years, where a few years ago, investors ultimately wanted to be in that particular product type, regardless of really what some of the defining characteristics were for each individual asset. Gateway versus more central areas or Sun Belt markets across the nation, quality in terms of Class A versus Class B, Class C, vintage, all of these various characteristics ultimately were coalescing and flattening some of the cap rates. There really weren't any premiums. At least that's what some of the feedback was during that time frame. I think that has reemerged very much so when we're thinking about some of the haves and have-nots, specifically around multifamily, where that premium is definitely very much apparent now from a cap rate perspective, from an interest perspective, for potential transaction activity. And also when we think about some of these vintage multifamily deals that are struggling because of that basis reset and some of the shift here in markets over the last few years. For those assets that have held up and are performing well and still have the occupancy, you know, financing is plentiful. So seeing and tracking a bit more around multifamily and some of the, again, some of that divergence, I think will be key over the course of 2026.
Thank you, Andrew, for that. If you, our listeners, are interested in learning more about participating in or getting access to our debt capital market survey, which is available for both the U.S. and EMEA region, check out the link in the show notes. The next survey will be opening in about a month. And if you participate, you're able to get the results. So I'd encourage you to register to make sure that you're on that invite list. It is no cost to you.
All right. Well, Omar, we've got a lot of other data releases and announcements about upcoming things here. So I want to run through those. It's going to be a busy week for data releases next week. We've got the Empire State Manufacturing Survey on the 17th. We have building permits and housing starts, durable goods orders, advanced retail and wholesale inventories on the 18th, the pending home sales index on the 19th, and then on the 20th, quite a few items, the PCE price index, the S&P flash services PMI, along with the flash manufacturing PMI, new home sales, and the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment final results for February. But we're, as mentioned, in the middle of earnings calls. And so one of the things we did is pull together the list of REIT earnings. On the 17th, we have Armada Hoffler and Kite Realty. On the 18th, Empire State Realty Trust. On the 19th, Americold Realty Trust, Host Hotels, Broadstone Net Lease, and Industrial Logistics Properties. And then on the 20th, a lot of the niche sectors. We have Lamar Advertising, Gaming and Leisure Properties, Park Hotels, and Extra Space Storage. But some Altus-related announcements. As mentioned at the top of the call, the Q4 2025 U.S. CRE Investment and Transactions Quarterly Report, one of our big flagship pieces, is coming out on February 25th. And then a little bit further in the future, and a quick plug before we wrap up, Altus Connect is coming up on April 13th through 15th at the Terranea Resort in Palos Verdes, California. 3 days of expert-led breakouts, hands-on Argus intelligence training, a lot of high-value networking with peers across the industry. We'd love to see you there. So we'll drop the registration link in the show notes. But Omar, I think that's all the time we have today. But before we sign off, I do want to encourage our listeners, if you like the show, please rate it. Give us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We do read them. Feel free to send us an email as well. AltusResearch@AltusGroup.com is our address. We'd love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. In the meantime, Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of the CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.